track 12. And now we come to our feature item, which is from TNF Soundings and is VE Day Memories, Past and Present. Rob from St Albans Talking Newspaper talks to Olga Hopkins about her memories of the war, VE Day, VJ Day, and her recent trip to Buckingham Palace to join the King and Queen for VE Day celebrations. This item is a little longer than usual. I've listened to it and found it very interesting, so I hope you enjoy it.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
My guest, and I'm very pleased to meet her and to be able to interview her, is Mrs. Olga Hopkins, who very recently visited Buckingham Palace for a reason that we're going to discover a bit later. But before we get there, can we go back to the beginning? Because you lived in interesting times. You were born in the 20s.
I was. Yes, I was born in Monmouthshire. My father was a miner. And having served all the way through the First World War, he came back and there was nothing else to do in South Wales. He had no other qualifications, and so he became a miner. They were very, very poor indeed. I remember it still vividly. By the 1930s, things had got a little better, but not much. I can really tell you with some pride that in 1937, my father must have been one of the very few Conservatives in South Wales, and he was asked to try and form a Conservative Miners' Union. Very foolishly, he accepted the challenge. Of course, he lost. And while the campaign was on, my mother and I were sent away for our own safety. So, you know, that was exciting. I remember 1939 and the growing anxiety and the inevitability that there was going to be war. And I do remember that awful morning at 11 o'clock when Mr. Chamberlain said that we are at war with Germany. My father said, "About bloody time," and my mother cried, and I was very bewildered. By then, we had moved further south to the lovely Vale of Glamorgan, and I was at school at a very small but very good girls' grammar school, Cowbridge High School then, is now an enormous comprehensive. My O-level, whatever we called it then, was really quite good. And so I went to a different school, a mixed school, Tonerevel Grammar School, and there was doing my higher school certificate. At the same time, I was a member of the Women's Junior Air Corps, a girl's equivalent of the ATC, and it was very good and I enjoyed it immensely. I could tell you the aeroplanes of the British Air Force and also the German ones. We distinguished by, we said, by sound, but we thought we knew what they looked like. I also did Morse code and some wonderful marching, at which the girls were very good. By Christmas of 1943, I was feeling a bit fed up with things, and I went into Cardiff and joined the WAF, just like that. And then I went home and told my father, who seemed rather proud. My mother cried again. I don't want to give a picture that she was a weak lady. She wasn't, I can assure you. She was lovely. So in January 1944, my father took me to Cardiff Station, 7:30 in the morning, to become a WAF.
And where did you go to from Cardiff?
In Turnhill, in Shropshire, where we did square bushing, which again I loved. And we had things like medicals. Now, that was very difficult for me, having gone to a girls' school where there weren't any showers, so we didn't have them, where nudity was a very, very private thing indeed. But when you're living communally, it's a different world. And we had to have what they called FFIs, which are free from infection. So half-stripped and look to see if you had any impetigo and things like that and nits in your hair and so on. And a general examination in a room with several other people. And I found that difficult. And then later on, this was all in one day. Later on, we had three injections, for one for cholera, one for tetanus, and one for malaria, I think. The next day we had aptitude and intelligence tests. I think the Air Force used the Ravens test. And after a while, this was marked, and somebody said, "You stand over there," to somebody else, "You stand over there." Anyway, I went in that corner, and I was more or less alone for most of it. And then they said, "Oh, you're going to be a wireless mechanic." Well, I think I laughed, really, which was usually my response to surprising things. A wireless mechanic entailed going to Glasgow Royal Technical School and the university for 6 months, followed by an intensive further 4 months in RAF Cranwell. In 1944, in June, we were in Glasgow and we were having our coffee break. And suddenly a man came in waving a newspaper and he said, "D-Day, D-Day has landed." And we cheered like mad. It was only far later in the day that we had some inkling of how awful that delay landing must have been and the number of casualties. After that, I went to a small station called Church Lawford and then soon went to Wellesbourne Mountford, where we had rather old bombers, Ansons and Blenheims. What I had to do, or we had to do rather, was a daily inspection, having got up at 6:30 and a mass breakfast and things. We then had to go out to the flight, and you'd been given a list of the numbers or the letters of planes. And so you got in the bomber and then you tuned them. If they were working properly, that was fine. And then you called up the watchtower and said, "How do you read me?" You'd say, "Was it 1 to 5? And if they said fine, that was fine. If they said anything else, there was work to be done in the plane. So we either retuned, if we could, and called the tower again. And that would probably be all right, because they were usually pretty minor faults. And then you'd test all the wiring in the plane and all the outlets, the press-to-talk buttons. If anything didn't work, you either mended the buttons and things like that in situ, and you just carried the set back to the section. And then if there was any fault to be discovered, we would do that in the afternoon and then replace it so that it would be serviceable the next day. And then, on my 21st birthday, I was moved to RAF Spitalgate. So on my important birthday then, I didn't have a card and I didn't have a present, but I was moved. My parents hadn't heard about moving and had to tell them afterwards. We were a small group moved together and we were pretty fed up, I can tell you. But we went to a party that night when we got to Spitalgate in Lincolnshire. There was a dance. There's always a dance in the Air Force. And we had a lovely big band and dancing. And I was a bit down in the dumps. But we had a flight of Dutch Air Force cadets come over from Amsterdam. And they were about to get their wings, I think, on our station at Spitalgate. So I told one of them, "I'm really miserable," and so on. And so he told the whole lot. And then I had a whale of a time, and the party was memorable, shall we say. This station was the final kind of training for pilots, and we had a very fine aeroplane, a Harvard American plane, and then we had some Spitfires, and that, of course, was the dream of anybody to have to go in here. But I suppose I must have done to have tested the wiring in the nose. It was so beautiful that it was a privilege just to be there, really, to see both planes, which were very, very fine. Soon we came to the 7th of May, because we were lying in bed. Perhaps we knew that something, you know, the war was coming to a critical time, and we were on our bed and listening to the American Forces Network, the glamorous WAF pyjamas in blue and white flannel and so on. And suddenly on the tannoy, there came an announcement. "The war is over. The war is over. It's going to be signed tomorrow. The war's over." And we all jumped up and we were sort of screaming and wasn't it wonderful? And then somebody said, "Oh, it's a party at the sergeant's mess." So off we went, put our battle dress over our pyjamas and went up to the sergeant's mess. and had a lovely party. I remember the band again, and we danced. I think I sang something, Don't Fence Me In. And then on the next day, we all went back to the section. We were flying again, and then in the afternoon, we did stop and listen to Churchill. So that was VE Day for me in 1945.
And that's why it's so important to you. You didn't go home during your time, did you?
I didn't go home until June the 7th, 1947. So I had two further years in what was a war service. We waited until the August when the war in Japan finished, but not until after the Hiroshima bomb had dropped. And then, I'm afraid to say, we all cheered like mad. And then we began to have thoughts when the second one was dropped in Nagasaki. But we were glad because the Japanese, we felt, would never have surrendered unless something like that had happened to them. They would have gone on. It was unthinkable that they should surrender. One of my best friends, who became my husband, Alan Hopkins, he was at the time on his way to the Far East in a cruiser. He landed in Sydney on the very day that the bomb dropped. And then after a few months of swanning around in Australia, the cruiser did a flag-waving tour of the Far East. So you name it, in the Far East, he went there. The personnel who had served longest, and they were either brought home, a lot of them had been in Germany and Italy and had a pretty tough time, and they were demobbed first, as was right. I think because it had taken so long to train wireless mechs and radar mechs as well, that they weren't in a hurry to get rid of us, but they were right to get rid of the men who had served, as I've said. But the time went on and on and on, and the joys of service, like I must say, became a little bit stale by the end. I'm sure I blotted my copybook in more than one way. They used to publish the demob number every month. One got very, very anxious knowing that the number was coming up. It did at last come up. It came up in May that I was to be demobbed.
Now, I said I'd take you back to the beginning because I discovered that you had been to Buckingham Palace. You mentioned VE Day as a day you remember very vividly from your war experience. Tell me what happened. Why were you at Buckingham Palace?
Well, my three children, unfortunately, Judith died. She would have been included, I'm sure. My three children heard the advertisement on the radio, and so they contacted the British Legion, and a wonderful woman called Emma became our chief correspondent, and everything fell in place from there. And then they said, would you like to go to Buckingham Palace? So I thought, in for a penny, in for a pound. I said, yes, I'd love to. I'd never having been there. And so I did, to the tea party. David organised a limousine to take Catherine and me there, and we went to a hotel, and they took us to the palace in small coaches. There were about 50 of us, I think. And then we were led onto the terrace, which is below the balcony. You know, the king and the royal family were all there. The crowds and the parade had come up the Mall. And then we saw the flypast just above us, straight over us, and that was thrilling. And then afterwards we went into a long, like a reception room, a rather plain room, but it was laid out with very, very long table too, and they had white tablecloths and food placed at intervals and told, you know, just sit down, sit where you like. And so we did. Very soon after that, the king and the queen and the prince and princess, Princess Anne and her husband, and Prince George, they all came in. We were not asked to stand. There was no trumpeting, nothing. It just came in and started to mix at once. also came in without any announcements. The top four, I think, of the government, Prime Minister, Foreign Minister, and again, no announcements when they came in. Nobody had to stand or salute or whatever. And then after that, the heads of all the armed forces came in. I might say that amongst the guests, I loved this part, amongst the guests, there were people who served in the forces, evacuees, fire watchers, firemen, policemen, air wardens, and people who worked on balloons and so on. Everybody had been contacted by the British Legion, and those who'd responded were there. And we all sat at these tables, and I realised soon that I was on the wrong side of the table because I was looking at Prince George sitting there just opposite. You couldn't speak to them across the table because that wouldn't have been polite. A little while later, an equerry came and tapped me on the shoulder and said, Her Majesty the Queen would like to speak to someone who served in the armed forces, a lady who worked in the armed forces. So did you? I said, yes, I was a WAF. And so she said, would you be prepared to do it? I said, of course. And then Queen Camilla came, and my daughter stood up and stood behind me. And then she sat down, held out her hand, which I touched. And I said, it's an honour, ma'am. And she said, no, no, the honour is mine to meet those who served during the war. So tell me about yourself. We talked for, it seemed ages, and it was about 5 or 10 minutes for a long time. And had the feeling she'd have gone on, really, but her equerry came and said it was time she moved on. And then after that, I had a long conversation with his name, I think, was Air Chief Marshal Sir Richard Knighton, who was the head of the Air Force. Well, I mean, he was charming, and there was no ceremony, no sitting to attention or anything like that, if you could sit to attention. But he, again, was very, very interested, particularly interested in the fact that I had been influenced by the Junior Air Corps, thinking how important now the ATC is. And also, he asked the same things that the Queen had most interested. And then he went, then we met a Rear Admiral who was called Timothy Lawrence. My daughter, who seems to know about these things, says, he's Princess Anne's husband. We did have an interesting and humorous chat for some time with him. And the whole day was just lovely. It was such a happy day. And to me, being in that room with people from the King and the head of the forces and the head of the government, all there, and us, ahoy polloi, all there. And that's what democracy is. That's what we fought for.
Thank you very much indeed.
It's a pleasure.
TNF Soundings.